Okay, great. All right. One technical piece of information. Firstly, thanks to Jason for coming in and helping us out here. If you want to make a comment, or especially if you're reading a passage, then if you could just hold this as if it were a microphone. This also, for your information, this class will be recorded on whyutorah.org, and so you can check it out there. And if anybody wants to see it there, comments you make will be recorded. So, all right. Well, again, thanks to Jason Lefkowitz for recording for us tonight. We we're saddened that one of our students who often attends our Anshe University passed away since our last session. And so tonight we want to learn in memory of Feigelbach, or Rav Moshe, in memory of Frances Zivinsky. We remember her well tonight. Good to have Maynard here. So, we're here to discuss the worldview of Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik. Very exciting for me. I remember when I was first in Rabbi Soloveitchik's class, they told me, I was in camp, and they told me that I was going to be in his class that year. I was so excited, and I remained so excited that while I was in his class, I was so nervous when I was writing my notes that I wrote in a different handwriting in his class than I had for any other class. It was like the small print. So when we mentioned Rabbi Soloveitchik, I get very excited. And to be able to have four evenings where we discuss this together is very exciting for me, and I thank you for joining me in this discussion. Our first discussion is really most offbeat and, on the other hand, somewhat mundane, and that is we're going to talk about his biography, but biography as philosophy. And we'll see later why, particularly when it comes to Rabbi Soloveitchik's philosophy and the school of thought that he comes from, biography as philosophy is exactly what it is. So we're going to look at a number of cases where he tells his biography, and we'll see if that matches his philosophy. So it's going to be a fun exercise. But first, let's pass these around. And don't be scared, but there are 10 pages there. As you see there, all these volumes here are volumes that you can get about Rabbi Soloveitchik. A lot of English stuff is coming out. In his lifetime, he didn't like to publish that much. But if you look here, you'll see, if you like stories about the Rav, this is the best, Rabbi Rekefet on the Rav. If you want something very moving, very spiritual, Uvi Kashta Misham, a new book, And You Shall Seek, and From There You Shall Seek. For those who are real philosophers, and I'm not, Halachic Mind. And for those who want a view of what the halacha is about and what sort of halachic thinking is all about, and the Soloveitchik, classic school of Rabbi Soloveitchik, and his grandfather, that's a halachic man, is very important. But there are many, many other books. Recently, these three books came out in Hebrew. I'm sorry for those who are not Hebrew readers, but Yuval Shurlo, who's making a big splash in Petach Tikva, student of Rabbi Lichtenstein. Rabbi Lichtenstein, of course, is Rabbi Soloveitchik's son-in-law. Chaim Navon came out with a book with somewhat of an approval from Rabbi Lichtenstein in the introduction, and then a book compendium of different writers on Rabbi Soloveitchik. So I was very fortunate. I had all kinds of aids to learn about his philosophy. So if we look first at Rabbi Soloveitchik's biography, for those of you who are more familiar with it, I don't want to bore you with the details of it, but if you look here on the first page, you'll see that although he grew up in the usual Talmud Torah, he started with the Talmud Torah, then he was taught by his father, tutored by his father, he went through the entire Talmud with his father. Can you picture that? In other words, I spent a lot of hours with Asher, but we didn't finish the whole Talmud. It takes a lot of hours to do that, and we're talking about with full analysis. This is not reading pages. He also studied at the University of Berlin, which was a major center of intellectual activity at that time. And here it gives the details. There are some chairs next door. In the room next door, it's open, and there are a bunch of chairs. There's a blue chairs and other chairs. Sorry about that. He was known as the Rav, so sometimes we'll refer to him simply as the Rav. It mentions that he studied the works of European philosophers and was a lifelong student of neo-Kantian thought, which we'll describe later. He wrote his PhD thesis on the epistemology, the history of knowledge, and metaphysics of the German philosopher Hermann Cohen. So there was a major a neo-Kantian philosopher named Hermann Cohen. He was a major contributor. If you really want to know about Hermann Cohen, speak to Mark Kaplowitz. He is an expert on Hermann Cohen and can tell you all about him. He pioneered the Maimonides school in Boston, and he succeeded his father, Rabbi Moshe Soloveitchik, as being the lead Talmud professor at Yeshiva University. He did not teach philosophy particularly at Yeshiva University, maybe here and there a course or two, definitely many lectures. His lectures in Talmud, which are recorded in that blue book over there, and many subsequent lecture books, drew thousands of people to come, and this was unheard of. You know, today you can fill a stadium with Jews learning Talmud, but in those days, 70s, to have a few thousand people coming to Yeshiva University to hear a rabbi talking was unheard of. That was the level of his popularity, and therefore he was known in America simply as the Rav. By the way, in Israel, he's not. In Israel, he's just Rabbi Soloveitchik, and the greed, Hagaon Rabbi Yosef Dov Soloveitchik, and the Rav in Israel is Rav Kook. That's the Rav for people in modern Orthodox circles, so to speak. Okay, so that's his biography. He both grew up as a student of this great Talmudist, as we'll describe in a second. And he also went to University of Berlin and studied and got a PhD and wrote a PhD in Neo-Kantian philosophy. So this is part of his biography. You look at the family tree. There are chairs in the room next door. If you look at the family tree, you'll see that he is a direct, both a descendant of a great line of rabbis, and these rabbis who he's descendant from were in turn students of the great Gaon of Vilna, the great Rabbi Elijah of Vilna. The Gaon of Vilna was one of the first modern scholars who knew all of the Talmud, Midrash, Tosefta, Sifra, every Midrash you could possibly know, and it was known as the great genius of Vilna. And his student was Rav Chaim Balazhin. Rav Chaim Balazhin is the father of Relka, who's married to Rav Yosef Dov Soloveitchik, whose son is Rav Yitzchak Zev Soloveitchik, whose son is Rav Yosef Ber Soloveitchik, not Joseph Ber that we're talking about tonight, but the first one, the Beis Halevi, whose son is Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, who according to Rabbi Soloveitchik is the greatest revolutionary of Talmudic study ever. And the rabbi we're talking about tonight, the Rav, studied under his grandfather as well. But his main teacher, who taught him the entire Talmud with all of its appropriate analysis based on the grandfather's teachings, was Rav Moshe Soloveitchik, who taught at Yeshiva University, where my father and Dr. Mervis's father were at Yeshiva University, until he passed away in 1941. And then Rabbi Yosef Dov took over at Yeshiva University in 1941, all the way through about 1986, when I was his student for the last 2.5 years, and he passed away. He had Parkinson's, so he didn't teach for the last few years of his life. So we're talking about a person. There are chairs in the next room. Sorry. Also outside. We're talking about a person who is so deeply entrenched in the Talmudic tradition that he is actually a descendant and a student of some of the greatest Talmudists of all time. He's also related to Rabbi Feinstein, if you look on the chart here, through some of the mothers. His mother is a cousin of the Feinstein, so Rabbi Feinstein in New York was also his cousin. That's on the one hand his heritage. They are anti-Zionists. He becomes a Zionist. He also went to the University of Berlin. So his biography is what? A biography of deep Talmudic study and at the same time, deep philosophical modern study. And if we ask ourselves just off the cuff right here, what might you think that would be his philosophy? Here are plenty of copies here. What might be the philosophy of someone who was both a great Talmudist and a great philosopher? What might be the philosophy? Might be similar to Maimonides somehow. Yes. What else? You would think that biography would dictate what? It doesn't dictate. You're saying it doesn't. Go ahead. Tell me it doesn't. Does it dictate? Doesn't it dictate? That's one of our questions tonight. Does your biography dictate your philosophy? Could you elaborate?
I mean, there are people who may have had similar backgrounds who don't have the Rav's philosophy.
Right. For instance, who are some people he met there at University of Berlin? Was the Rosh Yeshiva of Chaim Berlin, Rav Huttner, was in Europe there. He met the Lubavitcher Rebbe. just because people studied at the Sorbonne or wherever, or at University of Berlin, didn't necessarily mean that they embraced these two worlds and merged them together into some new great philosophy that merges the Jewish ideas and the secular ideas. So just because that's his biography doesn't mean that that's his philosophy. Or, hey, go ahead.
Understand the world and existence in terms of pure logic and empirical evidence, maybe even science, and for him to not just pursue it as coursework, but to get a PhD shows you would deduce an intense interest. So as a result, one might wonder, is he going through a questioning of his own Judaism through the endeavor of understanding philosophy?
One interesting thing is that he's the Rabbi Soloveitchik. You mentioned two interesting things. One is that philosophy should be something very heavily intellectual, serious, and clearly thought out. Is that what you said? What else did you say?
Logical,
yes. And we're going to see tonight there can be also another type of philosophy which is based purely on your experience and emotion. So we'll get to that in a minute. Then. The question, yeah, whether he took it very seriously, if you read the Halachic Mind, you'll see that, and he wrote this around the time he went to university, he was, as they say in Yiddish, he was totally holding in that issue, meaning he was totally ensconced in this world of philosophers. He could drop the names like with the best of them, and it's a very dense work, which people like Yoel can actually understand. But in any event, but if we look at his biography, Rabbi Herschel Schefter, for instance, looks at his biography and he says, I see that most of the time he was a community rabbi in Boston. He taught three days of lectures, intensive lectures, like about, you know, he would talk for about 4 hours. He started at 11 o'clock, supposed to finish by 3 when the boys went to college to study, but he often went overtime. 3-4 hours of Talmudic teaching, 3 days a week, Saturday night he'd give a big lecture, community lecture for hours. He was that one could look at his biography and say, you know what this man is? He's a Rosh Yeshiva. He's a man who teaches Talmud. He has a background in philosophy. He had a few friends, Rabbi Walter Wurzberger, blessed memory, or Shalom Karmi. They can discuss philosophy with him. But for the most part, his biography is that of someone who taught Talmud. Then the question is his philosophy similar to his grandfather, or is it dissimilar? And that's the most confusing because he writes this book, Halachic Man, which is basically a biography, a philosophical biography of Chaim Soloveitchik, of his grandfather. It purports to be the philosophy of his grandfather. And many people think it is a biography, but it also sounds like it's his philosophy. But is that his philosophy? And then we have this other book called And From There You Shall Seek, which seems to be a much more emotional view of Judaism and not a logical one like his grandfather, the scientist of the Talmud, we might call him. So the extent to which he's shaped by the thinking of his grandfather, the great Chaim Soloveitchik, whom the Rav viewed as the greatest revolutionary in the study of Talmud. You understand? Rabbi Soloveitchik thought that his grandfather had totally revolutionized the study of Talmud. And he explains his whole philosophy of Weltanschauung in this book, Halachic Man. To what extent is his philosophy similar to his or not? We'll get to that later. Okay. Now, in order to flesh out some of these questions as to whether his biography, in a very general sense, and we're just looking at his the Wikipedia version of his biography, a brief sketch of his biography, now let's get into the nitty-gritty. Let's look at the way he portrays his grandfather, and then the way he explains his own philosophy. So we said that he's a descendant of Rav Moshe Soloveitchik and Rav Chaim Soloveitchik. Here are two stories, the sunset story and the lulav and shofar story. It's actually a shofar story. So here are the two stories. One comes from the Halachic Man, page 38, and one is on page 61. Who would like to read that? If a Jew cognizes... Would like to read that? If you, Mindy, would you please, yes, talk like this? Okay, go ahead.
If a Jew cognizes, for example, the Shabbos laws and the precepts concerning the sanctity of the day in all their particulars, if he comprehends, via a profound study and understanding that penetrates to the very depths, the basic principles of a Torah law that take on form and color within the tractate Shabbat...
Okay, you understand. For him to study Talmud like his grandfather, you have to understand the basic principles. His grandfather was like a scientist. He determined the principles of the Talmud more than just the laws. Go ahead. If you do this, then what happens?
Then he will perceive the sunset of a Shabbos Eve not only as a natural cosmic phenomenon, but as an unsurpassably awe-inspiring, sacred, and exalted vision, an eternal sanctity that is reflected in the setting of the sun. I remember how once on the Day of Atonement, Yom Kippur, I went outside into the synagogue courtyard with my father, Rav Moshe Soloveitchik, just before the Ne'ilah service. It had been a fresh, clear day, one of the fine, almost delicate days of summer's end, filled with sunshine and light. Evening was fast approaching, and an exquisite autumn sun was sinking in the west, beyond the trees of the cemetery, into a sea of purple and gold. Rav Moshe, a halachic man par excellence, turned to me and said, "This sunset differs from ordinary sunsets, for with it forgiveness is bestowed upon us for our sins. The end of the day atones." The Day of Atonement and the forgiveness of our sins merged and blended here with the splendor and beauty of the world and with the hidden lawfulness of the order of creation, and the whole was transformed into one living, holy, cosmic phenomenon.
Okay. What is the, based on this little story, what's the philosophy of Rabbi Moshe Soloveitchik, the son of Rabbi Chaim Soloveitchik, his father of Moshe Soloveitchik? What is a beautiful sunset? A beautiful sunset on Yom Kippur is what?
Forgiveness.
It represents forgiveness. In other words, what Rabbi Soloveitchik calls the homo religiosus, a religious person would look at a sunset and what would he think? Usually a religious person sees a sunset, what does he think?
Another day gone, my life is wasted.
That's one idea. A beautiful sunset. Magnificence of creation. He feels small, feels humbled by the creation. It's so magnificent. And what does a halachic man see when he sees the sunset?
The halachic stage of the day.
The halachic phenomenon, right? He, on the one hand, Moshe Soloveitchik is like a scientist. That's the precise moment. That's very interesting. Forget about the beautiful vistas. It's a precise moment when atonement takes place. It's Ne'ilah. It's the end of the day. Some people say that the atonement of Day of Atonement takes place now. So with that sunset, that's what happens. So on the one hand, it seems here that Rabbi Soloveitchik's history, his biography, his background, is one in which there is little room for emotional role, for a psychological role, and it's pure law and appreciation of the Jewish law. Do you see another strand within that very paragraph? A contrary strand within that paragraph.
I mean, I think the idea of forgiveness, although I didn't see it from a halachic perspective, because I mean, being forgiven is highly emotional and something that's very gratifying
okay.
to people.
Okay.
It gets poetic in the end.
It gets poetic. Can you elaborate on that? Yes, I want to go back to that. Go ahead.
Splendor, the beauty of the world, mm-hmm. the hidden lawfulness. I mean, and it's a transformation. You know, it talks about how creation, everything is transformed. It's like unified, this beauty and forgiveness together. I mean, it's a poetic.
So we're going to have yes, very much so. We're going to have a special session on the question of whether Rabbi Soloveitchik is green. It's called Greener Pastures. We want to know, is Rabbi Soloveitchik living in this sort of a tension between sort of the halachic mind, which looks at everything as a legal phenomenon, you know, or on the one hand, and on the other hand, a religious persona who sees everything as so beautiful and a reflection of God's greatness. And is he sort of struggling between the two, or does he come to a synthesis where it's all transformed into one beautiful thing? That beautiful sunset is a beautiful atonement, right? It's beautiful, and it's atonement, and it's all together being cosmic and holy and legal all in one, right? So you see a synthetic element, an element of the two ideas of the legalism and this emotionalism merging together. But the basic story, that's Rabbi Soloveitchik's, you know, flowery language, but the basic story is a story that says that my tradition, my upbringing says that when you see a beautiful sunset, thou shall think of halacha. You know, is it time to daven mincha, or is it ma'ariv, or you know, not, don't think about how I should want to write a beautiful poem about God. Okay? So, so
well,
he...
They're both from the same source. I mean, the same source. I mean, the only one that can create the whole sunset is the only one that can dictate halacha to us.
Right, of course, it's all one, right, but Rabbi Soloveitchik, in this dialectic approach, the dialectic was very popular in German thought. I'm not an expert on it. Talk to Yoel and Dr. Kaplowitz about it, but he's very much influenced by the dialectic, and his grandfather, Rabbi Chaim Soloveitchik, who never stepped foot in a university and wouldn't want to, he also always saw things in terms of two halachos, zwei halachos. There's an element of this in this law, and there's also an element of that. And so even the idea of the emotional and the legal. So the Rabbi Soloveitchik actually developed a language for this within halacha called the Maisa HaMitzvah. There's the act of a mitzvah and the Kiyum HaMitzvah, the fulfillment of the mitzvah. So we'll see in a minute about the shofar. What's the act of blowing a shofar?
Blowing
a shofar. And what's the fulfillment of a shofar? You could fulfill the mitzvah by hearing it, true. What's the fulfillment? What does it fulfill?
Inspiring yourself to tshuva.
Inspiring or something like that. So Rabbi Soloveitchik sees in every mitzvah or most mitzvahs two elements. But it seems that the story seems to say that no, his background does not have both sides. His background has one side, and that's the halachic man. But maybe not. So when we get to the issue of greener pastures, of whether everything is supposed to sort of merge into some great synthesis, or whether there's a struggle between what Jeff saw as two common themes, but whether there's actually a struggle between my natural self, who looks at everything with great awe, like a child, and my more intellectual self, who looks at everything with legal eyes and intellectual eyes. So is there a tension between those two? Moving along to a different story. The first paragraph simply says that when you do a mitzvah, the Kabbalists say, oh, before you shake a lulav, you should think about the names of God and how it relates to the four species, and you should think of the mystical meanings of lulav and esrog and what it does in the worlds and how it changes everything. And Noda Behuda, quoted here on the left, not by name, says nonsense. When you, as a student of the Gaon of Vilna, we say no. When you do a mitzvah, just have in mind you're doing a mitzvah that God commanded, cut and dry. So here's a problem: there's a story of the shofar blower in his community. Now remember, Rabbi Soloveitchik is from White Russia. He lived in different cities. His father was a rabbi of a small city. His grandfather was from Brest-Litovsk, a larger city. Remember that. The Chabad Hasidim that we know today, they are the only Lithuanian Hasidim. There's in Poland, full of Hasidim, like the Shul, Anshei Sfar, Polish Jews, Southern Poland, Galicianers. But Lithuanians were Litvaks, were cold and intellectual and not Hasidic. But the Chabad was an intellectual Hasidus found there. So the story of his biography is that when he went to yeshiva, his father sent him to cheder like everybody else. So he went to cheder, and the grandfather discovers that the kid doesn't know anything. He comes to school and he discovers that they're pretending to learn Gemara and stuff like that. But underneath is a Tanya, is the Chabad book underneath. So they say that that's part of his biography being part of his philosophy. Some of the softer parts of Rabbi Soloveitchik's philosophy come from that biography, that he's a Bissel Chabadnik also, and he had a warm relationship with the Lubavitcher Rebbe. Anyway, so now let's take a look at a conflict in the town of Rav Moshe Soloveitchik between a Chabadnik and the Soloveitchiks. Once my father, who would like to read that? I can't get up because I'm stuck. Yeah, I'm wired. Yes. Thanks.
Once my father was standing on the synagogue platform on Rosh Hashanah.
The Bima.
Ready and prepared to guide the order of the sounding of the shofar.
You know, you say Tekiah, Shevarim. Go ahead.
The shofar sounder, a God-fearing Chabad Hasid, who was very knowledgeable in the mystical doctrine of the Alter Rebbe, Rabbi Shneur Zalman of Lille.
That's the first Chabad Rebbe, was Rabbi Shneur Zalman, who wrote the book that was hiding under Rabbi Soloveitchik's Gemara. Go ahead.
Began to weep. My father turned to him and said, "Do you weep when you take the lulav? Why then do you weep when you sound the shofar? Are not both commandments of God?"
Or what was Rabbi Moshe Soloveitchik complaining about? He's complaining. Here's a Jew crying during the shofar blowing. Isn't that beautiful, right? And the rabbi says, "What are you crying for? Do you cry when you shake a lulav?" What's the rabbi saying? Judaism is not emotional. Judaism is intellectual, right? And we're fulfilling the will of God, right? Nothing to cry about. Continue. Shocking, right? Shocking, go on. This is his background, right? This is a great philosopher, or Joseph P. Soloveitchik. His background is, don't give me your fancy philosophies. Do the will of God. Continue.
The mystic understands the symbolic significance of the sounding of the shofar, the concept of a plain note, whereby man attempts to pierce through lawful existence and reach the throne of glory of the Atik Yamin, the ancient one, the Deus Absconditus. The sounding of the shofar, according to the outlook of Rav Shneur Zalman, expresses the powerful aspiration of homo religiosus.
There again, Rabbi Soloveitchik contrasts the homo religiosus, the religious persona, with the other... with the homo scientific, the scientific man. Go ahead.
To extricate himself from the straits of contraction, the divine realm of strength, and enter into the wide spaces of expansion, the divine realm of grace.
This is all Kabbalistic stuff. Go ahead.
And from thence to rise above the seven lower divine realms, the cornerstones of the cosmic structure, into the hidden world, in which the light of the Ein Sof, the completely hidden infinite God, gleams and shines, as it were.
In other words, this prayer has to go through all the levels of seven emanations, then it goes to the world of knowledge, and then it goes to the Ein Sof, to the purity of God in his ultimate essence. Go ahead.
Man's weeping on Rosh Hashanah, according to this doctrine, is the weeping of the soul that longs for its origin, for the rock from whence it was hewn, that yearns to cleave to its beloved, not in hiding, but openly. The sounding of the shofar protests against reality and denies the universe itself.
So what's Rabbi Soloveitchik's philosophy? Can you discern it from the text? Right? Is his biography his philosophy? Is he saying, the strange Chabadnik, he has all these mystical ideas, but we don't do that. Or is he saying, you know what? I can explain the Chabad philosophy better than he can, and I understand the Chabad philosophy the same time as I have my own philosophy. So this is from Halachic Man. Where is that book? We mentioned it before. In Halachic Man, again, there's always a question: is this Rabbi Soloveitchik's philosophy, or is this his grandfather's philosophy? In this case, his father's philosophy. His father, who was sort of a clone of his grandfather. This is the question, and later Rabbi Soloveitchik develops this idea of that there's both, that there's the Maisa Mitzvah, the act, is simply to blow it. Nothing else. You blow a shofar, lulav, doesn't make a difference. You fulfill the divine command. And then there's a Kiyum Mitzvah, the fulfillment of shofar is an act of prayer, it's an act of cosmic challenge, all kinds of different things. All right, so we see that there's a bit of a tension between his grandfather's philosophy, his father's philosophy, and his own. We saw it in the setting of the sun and in the blowing of a shofar. Moving along. Now, we talk a bit about, you know, where do we find God? We mentioned that, you know, of course, talking about philosophy, so maybe we want to describe, you know, how do we get to God? How do we seek God? So the book will be Kashtem Misham, and from there you shall seek. This is based on a verse in Deuteronomy about seeking God, returning in tshuva. And so in this book, he talks about finding God, right? Heschel wrote a book, you know, God in Search of Man. This is a similar type of theme, and all these different philosophers overlapped in their writings. Sometimes Martin Buber's phrases can be found in Rabbi Soloveitchik, the I Thou. Anyway, they all borrow each other's ideas. So here's a book about you know, sort of finding God. So where does he find God, and how does it relate to his biography? Or is it a pure philosophy? You find God through philosophical, logical inquiry. That's the question. Okay, so let's take a look. Here's from Rabbi Rakefet's book. Some have accused Rabbi Rakefet's book of being overly sort of storytelling, reducing Rabbi Salvechik to little Hasidic advices or Rebbe stories. But if you combine that book with other books that he wrote, there were more other books of Rabbi Salvechik's, you get a fuller picture. In any event, Rabbi Rakefet's a wonderful man and wonderful teacher in Israel. Anyway, let's see what he said about longing for the departed. Warning, this is a very powerful passage. Who would like to read it, please? Would you just grab the... thank you. The longing.
Longing for the departed. The longing for one who has died and is gone forever is worse than the torment of the depths of the grave. The soul is overcome and shattered by fierce longing for the departed. Before this, Rosh Hashanah, in my mind, I saw my father, the gown of blessed memory, standing before me. He was the only Rebbe and teacher I ever had.
Again, he didn't go to school. His father tutored him after he pulled him out of that little cheder. Go ahead.
I opened my heart to him and said, "My father, my master, I have so many new insights that I have developed in the laws of the temple sacrifices on Yom HaKippurim, on the topic of mitzvot, lav, lehenot, Nitnu, mitzvah are not intended for personal enjoyment. And on the laws of blowing the shofar, I have ideas that would have pleased you and brought you enjoyment, some that you would not have accepted and would have refuted. That is how I spoke to my father in my vision, although I knew that I would never receive a response to my words. Oh, how much I would give to exchange words of Torah with my father for only 5 minutes. But I know that this man who loved me so much and whom I was so close to is now so distant. My heart breaks with longing to speak with him for only 5 minutes, a period of time which we did not know how to properly value when he was still with us. The same is true regarding my mother and my wife. A few days ago I was writing this annual sermon on repentance. I always used to talk about it with my wife. She would help me develop and polish my ideas. Again this year, while I was writing this lecture, I wanted to ask her, could you please help me? Should I shorten this idea? Should I expand on this point? Should I stress this concept or another one? I asked my wife, but there was no response. If there was a reply, it was lost in the rustling of the trees and did not reach me.
Beautiful. It's amazing. Rabbi Salvechik, in his biography, suffered a lot of losses. Loss of his father was early on in his life when he was about to take over at Yeshiva University as the major lecturer, the major teacher. But then the loss of his wife came at the same time as the loss of his brother and his, I think his mother, yes. Three losses, I think you're right. He had three losses in one short time. And therefore mourning and longing became very much a part of his philosophy. This is part of his biography, but it's also part of his philosophy. And we're going to go from there to this. So that's a little bit of his experience of mourning. My mother likes to say that, that isn't it amazing, you know, how emotional and how loving this great intellectual rabbi, you know, could be. And in any event, let's take a look at the next section. It's called The Need to Pray. It's from Majesty and Humility, which is one of the essays he wrote. He wrote some magnificent essays in Tradition magazine. This is one of them. And it discusses mourning, but here we shift from the mourning into finding God. Who would like to read this? Jeff, would you? Thanks.
With the arrival of the dark night of the soul, in moments of agony and black despair, when living becomes ugly and absurd, plainly nauseating, when man loses his sense of beauty and majesty, God addresses him, not from infinity, but from the infinitesimal, not from the vast stretches of the universe, but from a single spot in the darkness which surrounds suffering man from within the black despair itself.
Notice he likes to make up different men. We're going to talk about Rosh Chodesh man, there's the halachic man, And here there... No, keep going. You have more to go. And here's suffering man. Suffering. And there's one of the essential typologies of man is suffering man. Go ahead. 11 years.
11 years ago, my wife lay on her deathbed, and I watched her dying, day by day, hour by hour. Medically, I could do very little for her. All I could do was to pray. However, I could not pray in the hospital. Somehow, I could not find God in the whitewashed long corridors among the interns and the nurses. However, the need for prayer was great. I could not live without gratifying this need. The moment I returned home, I would rush to my room, fall on my knees, and pray fervently.
Now, mind you, falling on your knees in prayer is not a classic form of prayer. He's just saying he fell on his knees. That's what it was, just an emotional reaction. Go ahead.
God in those moments appeared not as the exalted, majestic king, but rather as a humble, close friend, brother, father. In such moments of black despair, he was not far from me. He was right there in the dark room. I felt his warm hand, so to speak, on my shoulder. I hugged his knees, so to speak. He was with me in the narrow confines of a small room, taking up no space at all. God's abiding in a fenced-in, finite room,
finite locus,
manifests his humility and love for man. In such moments, humilitas Dei, which resides in the humblest and tiniest of places, addresses itself to man.
So here's a man who studied detailed philosophy. Surely he studied all the proofs of God, all kinds of things like that. And where does he find God?
Losing his wife.
Right? Like a pasher de yid, like a simple Jew, just in an emotional, in despair, in suffering man, he finds God. Now, the idea that he's using his experiences to convey his philosophy is I don't know much about it, but it relates to the idea of existentialism, that a lot of the great answers to finding God in this world are not found in logical proofs, but rather in the experiences of man. So, as an existential philosopher, it's not strange that he will use his experiences to describe himself. As a descendant of the Salvechik family, who take great pride in privacy and in the containing your emotions, it's very strange, given his biography, that he is so open about his emotional experiences. So we talk about the overlap or conflict between his biography and his philosophy. His philosophy is that you find God through your experiences and through suffering. But his biography was that even when you're standing there in Rosh Hashanah listening to the shofar, you just have in mind that you're fulfilling the divine commandment. That's it. Do you see the vast gap?
He writes about it publicly, but his experience was private. He couldn't find it in the hospital in public. He had to go back to his own place and be private.
I mean, even though he shares it publicly,
the experience is
private. Right. It's not like one of these televangelists who's finding God on television, right? He's right, right. It's true. Yes.
Could it be he didn't? These are the people that are gone that had that feeling that he tried to resemble, but his feelings were different. And once they were gone, then he could start to show that part of himself that really was himself.
You're saying that this is a break from his parents and grandparents.
Right? Isn't that...
Could be.
Interesting.
Right, it could be. But then again, right, when you read Halachic Man, you realize that he's describing in very poetic terms this very cold, cold philosophy. And that it's not actually as cold as you think it is. In Rabbi Yuval Shurlo's book on Rabbi Salvechik, it's just a little monogram, but it's very nice. He says, he says that one possibility is that he only did this for pedagogic purposes, meaning he would never do this if he was a private citizen. But for pedagogic purposes, he reveals himself. He says, yes. Or he does mention that it could be that this Soloveitchik tradition of being so private is not him. Right? That's one possibility. The other possibility is that it is him. He believes in that things, that the more holy, the more private, the deeper feeling is, the more it should not be shared. He believes in that. But as a teacher, he has to share the emotional experience. He bemoaned the fact that although he was such a great Talmudic teacher and his students were absorbing his message very well, they were bright students at Yeshiva University and they were absorbing it and they were going out and teaching it, and he can tick off all the great teachers, Rabbi Lichtenstein, Rabbi Self, Rabbi Schechter, and Rabbi Ganak, and all these people who got his learning very well. He was worried that they weren't getting the experiential part. And that's where a book like And From There You Shall Seek comes, and that's where some of these, the need to share these personal experiences comes. He wants to share the godly experience within this cold halachic world and life. Okay. Yes.
You said something. First of all, I want to refer to something you just said about they're not getting the experiential part.
Right.
But before I do that, the preface of it is I don't quite see this as remarkable as you do. What there is something remarkable about it, and that is, he has such a great grasp of the process of his experiences and is able to express it so well. Mm-hmm. That's remarkable. And, mm-hmm. And the fact that other people have chosen to be so private, not even try to express it, that's the way things are. But it doesn't mean those people, circling around to the point, don't get the experiential side of it. It just may not be discussed and debated and written. What's right. Not remarkable is what he's saying. I mean, it's remarkable in his experience, but everybody has their own sort of version of that.
Anybody want to comment on that? So Ben is saying, of course, he had an emotional experience and he found God within that experience. What's different about
it? His father or his grandfather mm-hmm. didn't have that. Although that story regarding the mitzvah right. says in the attitude, but it doesn't say about that
prior. Right. His grandfather, right, was against crying at certain key moments in life. So that's interesting. Right? His grandfather said that the holier the feeling, the more private it should be. Anyway, we'll see Rosh Chodesh man later, and maybe we'll talk more about it. But anyway, we must go on. Now, yes.
Private feeling. Private experience is that more holy?
Is he claiming that even where maybe the student has a different view? He, as a student, feels no. He's making it holier by sharing it. Maybe so. Maybe it's a kiddush Hashem. It's like kaddish. You share the kaddish with everybody. Could be. Now, so we saw it as a story. Then you can see it in his book. You can see this type of the idea of God revealing himself to suffering man. Who wants to read that for us? In From There You Shall Seek, the philosophy on page 5. Philosophy, who wants to read that for us? Esther, would you? I think you should pass that to Esther. Thanks.
In the middle.
Yes.
God's revelation at times of crisis, in the depths of despair and distress, is a basic principle of Judaism. Sometimes God does not reveal himself to the contented soul. He reveals himself to the mute soul, battered by weariness and exertion. Sometimes God reveals himself to one who grieves for the ruin of his temple and the destruction of its altars while avoiding one who dedicates his temple and stands at the side of his offering.
There's a story of Solomon. He was dedicating the temple and God wouldn't appear. Like, come on, I want a cloud or something or other. You know, nothing happened. But on the other hand, so God might reveal himself to someone who is, like the story in the Talmud where somebody's in one of the ruins of the temple and God appears there. Go ahead.
Sometimes God reveals himself to the one who grieves for the ruin of his temple and the destruction of its altars, while avoiding one who dedicates his temple and stands at the side of his offering. Sometimes he does not reveal himself to the rational individual, but to one who is confused about life, who is bankrupt and has lost track of his world. From time to time, man's salvation comes out of distress.
So we get the idea that this is very different from medieval philosophy. In medieval philosophy, you have to know God. According to the Rambam, we thought he'd be like Maimonides. Maimonides said you have to know God, you have to learn proofs of God. And this is a different kind of an idea. You know how you learn God? You know God when you're in trouble and you have sorrows and you feel his hand on your shoulder. And, right? And he describes that he's had these experiences. He's not some sort of what they call a cold Lithuanian Jew who has no feeling. Okay, let's continue with more biography. I'm switching to biography. You can continue reading, but we're going to put you on the bottom of the page. Now for in this book, and that from there you shall seek, Rabbi Soloveitchik asked the experience of the natural experience where you experience the beauty of God through nature and the sort of Masorah experience where you experience the beauty of God through the revelation at Sinai and the revelation through your teachers of the Torah. So here is Rabbi Soloveitchik's, one of his most famous religious experiences is a very Jewish experience. You see, until now, the experience of the loss of his wife, which, by the way, he was so grieved. I'm not saying he was unusual, but it was unusual for a rabbi to visit his wife's grave so often. I think he went every week or something. This is very not Soloveitchik. Like some rabbis say, you should only go every year, or you should don't have to go at all. Like interesting, Rabbi Schneerson, the Lubavitcher rabbi, and Rabbi Soloveitchik, so attached to their wives. They were coming from such a different culture. They were the only people who actually understood them. Rabbi Schneerson's wife was not that involved, I understand, in his life, in his intellectual life, spiritual life. But Rabbi Soloveitchik's wife was a PhD like he was, and she was a big part of his life in every way. Anyway, so he's going to contrast the experience of finding God through nature. And now we're going to find God through the Masorah. The Masorah means the tradition of Judaism, the transmission of Judaism from teacher to student. And you have to understand, Rabbi Soloveitchik is part of this great chain, right? When he's talking about tradition, he's living it. It's his biography. He is the descendant of the descendants of rabbis after rabbis after rabbis. And he's got that stuff. He's got that genius to continue that line. Continue on spirituality. This is from Rabbi Rakefet's book called The Rav, what I call the storybooks. Go ahead.
Whenever I started here,
that's a lecture.
The door opened and another old man walks in and sits down. My students call me the Rav. He's older than the Rav. He's grandfather of the Rav. His name is Rav Chaim Brisker.
He came from the city of Breslitov, Brisk. Go ahead.
Without his method of study, no shear be delivered nowadays.
He thinks that there's no way to discuss Talmud without Rav Chaim Brisker. Go ahead.
Then the door opens quietly again, and another old man comes in. He is older than Rav Chaim because he lived in the 17th century. His name is Rav Shabbatai HaKohen, the famous
Shach.
From the initials of his book,
Sifsei Cohen.
So, who is the
Shach? He's just a rabbi who lived in the 1600s, and he has a commentary on the Code of Jewish Law, one of the main commentaries.
He must be present on the civil law, deny,
Mamonot,
be discussed. Do we study Baba Kama or Baba Metzia? And more visitors show up, some from the 11th, 12th, 13th century, some even live in antiquity. Among them are Rabbi Akiva, Rashi, Rabbi Tom,
the Rabbi, and the Rashba.
More and more keep on coming in.
Sorry. So this is part of that passage where when Rabbi Soloveitchik studies, he feels the whole Masorah community, all of the people of the great tradition of Judaism coming in. So he finds God not through the sunset, not through a tragedy, but he also finds God through the Masorah community. He's like living in this like dream world of all these rabbis who are discussing things with each other, you know, the Rambam and the Ravid. And then he describes how when he was growing up, go ahead.
What do I do? Introduce him to my pupils, and the dialogue commences. The Rambam states the halacha, and the Chabad disagrees sharply. At times, the Rabbi utilizes harsh language against the Rambam. The boy jumps up to defend the Rambam against the Rabbi. In his defense, the student expresses himself rashly, too outspoken in his critique of the Rabbi. Young boys are wont to speak in such a fashion, so I correct him and suggest more restrained tones. Another boy jumps up with a new idea. The Rashba smiles gently. I try to analyze what the young boy meant. Another boy intervenes. Rabbeinu Tam is called upon to express his opinion, and suddenly a symposium of generations comes into existence. Young students debate earlier generations with an air of daring familiarity, and a crescendo of discussion ensues. We all speak one language. The whole earth was one of language.
Right. So we're one purpose. So this is there's the natural experience where we experience God through nature, and there's the Masorah experience where we experience God through Sinai, through our teachers, and through being part of this symposium, intellectual history of the symposium generation. Now, again, as Rabbi Yoel is alluding to, none of these rabbis are talking about anything very spiritual, quote unquote. They're talking about, you know, what happens when an ox gores a person or something. But through the study of Torah, it's another way of finding God. So that's the experiential part. He describes in the next page as a child, he'd be sitting in the room, and if you want, you can take this home and read it. He'd be sitting in the room, and he'd hear that his father was teaching the students, high school age or what, and there's a problem. All the commentators are arguing against the Rambam, against Maimonides, and Maimonides seems to be in trouble. And the little boy, Rabbi Salvechik, is a little boy, and he's listening, and he tells his mother, what are we going to do? Maimonides is in trouble, and no one's coming to his defense. And his mother says, go back to sleep, be okay, your father will solve the problem. And he will answer the question that's being asked. So this is how he grows up. He grows up as part of this invisible community, and this is also where he finds, I would argue, where he finds God as well. I would say in the philosophy on page 8, there's a revelational consciousness. You see, in the second paragraph on page 8, the philosophy from this pink book here, right? The meaning of revelational consciousness is this. In other words, not the natural consciousness, not finding God in the sunset. Revelation meaning Sinai. Man cannot come to God on his own through the initiative of his own spirit. The world is a dead end, which does not permit passage to the realm of the eternal and the absolute. If you just try to find God from a beautiful sunset, he believes you will reach a wall where you can't go any further. Man's spirit, soaring up to the heavens, propelled by massive jolts and firing longing, reaches the shadow of the Almighty. The image of his images, she will never rest in God's bosom and cling to her lover. Therefore, God revealed himself to human beings and said to them, I am the Lord your God. There's a revelation, there's Mount Sinai, there's the Torah, there's the Masorah community, and that's where we really find God, in a stronger way than the sunset. A truth of this sort, says the revelational consciousness, the Mount Sinai consciousness, will never be exhausted by human reason. The very vision of the awesome and comprehensible revelation takes place against man's will and without his consent. In other words, when it comes to spirituality, I'm as spiritual as I want to be. It's something I do on my own. But when I'm confronted with Sinai and with all the rabbis, that imposes itself on me. It's a more coercive experience. You see, the natural people in America that want to be spiritual on their own terms. Be spiritual. I feel like doing this kind of spiritual thing, that kind of spiritual thing, whatever I want to do. It's basically about me, what I want to do. And that's fine. That's one experience of finding God is through nature. But that's very free and free spirit. The revelational experience is more coercive. The mountain of Sinai stands over our head, tells us what to do. And he believes that ultimately he can only find God through Sinai. And I would argue there's a relationship with these stories, this biography of finding God through the community of Torah discussions, intellectual Torah discussions. Okay. The relationship between biography and philosophy comes to a different sort of, I'm going to go a little offbeat at this point, the relationship between biography and philosophy comes to a new expression in this next paragraph. Who would like to read that? It's from Divrei Hagut. This is a Hebrew work, which you see that gray book down there. Yeah, thanks. The gray book there. And thank you. And I translated the little paragraph there for you. Who would like to read that for us? And Jeff, just grab that mic there. And come sit in a more comfortable chair.
The Torah was wedded to Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, his grandfather, while to other great leaders of his generation it was betrothed.
He has no problem in disparaging other rabbis. He believed that his grandfather was on a totally different pedestal than others. He only read certain books, by the way. He wouldn't read any of the rabbis. Medieval rabbis, you can read all of them. But recent rabbis, he would only read the ones that had that sort of sharpness of his grandfather. Go ahead.
Out of this difference came an epistemologic and methodologic revolution, which is named for Rav Chaim. Rav Chaim, who was blessed with a clear halacha intuition, invented the notion of conceptualization in halacha. He created a world of ideas.
In other words, let's say the laws of kashrut. The laws of kosher are not just do this, do that, don't do this, don't do that. They're concepts, constructs. They say that, I once heard a story, it's somewhat apocryphal, that the one man who's now the head of kashrut at the OU, that originally he didn't need to study the details of the law. He knew the concept so well from Rabbi Soloveitchik, he could answer the answer correctly on any test, because he had the concepts down. And I'm sure later he went and studied all the details too, but continue.
My uncle of blessed memory was left as the only one in the
We didn't mention his uncle. His uncle, if you're in Israel, the Briskers are not the person we're talking about tonight. The Briskers, the continuation of the Chaim Soloveitchik tradition, are the descendants of the Brisker Rav, who was a rabbi in Brisk. It was his uncle, and who lived in Bnei Brak, who did not approve of Rabbi Soloveitchik's attending university. I think they didn't speak to each other for a certain amount of time, and they were at odds. And his children have the Brisker method in Israel, and they have a whole yeshiva of Brisk. They're considered the premier, one of the premier yeshivas, according to some people. In Israel, of great deep learning. Go ahead.
My uncle of blessed memory was left as the only one in a generation in the kingship of Torah, for there was no one like him. The Torah was the wife of his youth. He reveled in her love. A quiet conversation took place between her and him, like a husband conversing with his wife. He felt her essence, and he discerned her heart.
In other words, for a Soloveitchik, your philosophy and your biography merge when basically the Torah becomes your wife. Continue. Yemezi Karon. This is another book, that orange book at the bottom and that pile there. It's about the holidays, about Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur. And the shofar on the front cover. And there's some more Kabbalistic articles there too. Interesting. Go ahead.
To our fortune, we were given the oral Torah, and the sanctity of Israel became a sanctity of the body.
Okay, you understand there's a written Torah, that's the Tanakh, the Bible, and the oral Torah is the Talmud, and stuff like that. But he says, but the oral Torah was supposed to be oral, so where is it written? Go ahead.
A person of Israel is holy because there is an identity between him and the Torah, because Israel itself is Torah, and Torah is Israel. On what was the oral Torah written? Where was it collected? On the mind and on the mind. On the mind and heard of a Jew.
No, the heart.
The heart of a Jew. In his memory, in his thinking, in his feelings, and intuition. The Jew is the cloth, the parchment, the ink, and the letters. All this is not cold as usual, but sizzling and boiling. The cloth is not plain paper, but a feeling heart. A spiritual soul and a personality, the holiness is internal, original, and independent. The oral Torah is not an ark, but in the ark of the covenant hidden in the recesses of the Israeli soul.
Israelite soul. So, according to Rabbi Soloveitchik, if you really have the proper experience of Torah study, then the relationship between your biography and your philosophy is that your philosophy, your Torah is written on you. You become part and parcel with the Torah. This idea, the original, there's a basic question here. Are you supposed to be original? You see, if you're getting the Torah, a strange idea. If you're getting the Torah, you should be getting something from someone else. Original, there's the theme of originality and creativity comes up a lot in Rabbi Soloveitchik's writings, naturally because of his biography, because his grandfather was so original. Okay. So that's an interesting relationship between the person and the philosophy. Then in Divrei Hagut, he talks about, we were talking before about in his biography, the idea of emotionalism was a problem. You didn't want to be overly emotional. Immanuel Kant apparently has said something similar. Let's see. Lisa, would you continue for us? Oh, wait a second. Who else didn't have a chance? Maynard, would you like to read for us? Okay. You all, do you want to read? Okay, great. Give everyone a chance. Immanuel Kant.
Immanuel Kant, in his day, announced the independence of the pure wisdom of the scientific mathematical conscience. It is not influenced by feelings, etc.
Okay, you see? In other words, Immanuel Kant says, there, when you come up with a scientific theory, don't tell me what my psychology is. Don't tell me what my that I hated my mother. Don't tell me that I'm living in an era where, according to the history in that time, I start thinking mathematics, science is not influenced by psychology, and right there are pure ideas. Sounds similar to somebody who we might know. Go ahead.
Reb Chaim fought the war of independence of the wisdom of the halacha and demanded its complete autonomy.
Psychologization.
I never heard of that word. Of social.
Sociologicalization. Go ahead. No, it's turning everything into psychology, psychologizing everything, turning everything into sociology. Go ahead.
Of the halacha are an offense to its soul. Just as such an attempt will destroy mathematical thinking. If the thinking of the halacha depends on personal factors, then it loses all its objectivity and deteriorates to subjectivity, which has no substance.
Right. Obviously, let's say at the same time he's writing this in Jewish Theological Seminary, the conservative movement, they're focusing very much on the historical. Why did Rabbi Yehuda say this? And why did Rabbi Meir say that? It all has to do with history. And then there's the field of psychology, of course, is developing very much in the beginning of the 20th century and the previous century. And there's a great temptation to see everything through the prism of psychology, right? And he's fighting that very strongly. So Rabbi Soloveitchik agrees with that. You see, before we talked about a lot of emotionalism, and that was Rabbi Soloveitchik's philosophy, but we also talked about the coldness of his grandfather. And here, he likes that when he's studying Torah, he doesn't want to get all emotional about the shofar. He wants to understand when do you blow it and how do you blow it and what's the concept, what's the conceptualization of this halacha. So on that point, that Kant, who's part of his philosophical world, and his grandfather, right, are on the same page. So the two biographies come together. Okay. And then you see in the halachic mind, he talks a lot about objectification of halacha, reaches its highest expression in the halacha, right? In halacha, right, we're not subjective. So, et cetera, et cetera. So, the idea of objectification, you can see it there in halachic mind on page 9. Okay. Finally, we turn to the last page. Wow, we actually made it. I'll try to, just in 10 minutes, for this. Okay. Firstly, we need to talk about Rosh Chodesh Man. He's one of my favorite men Rabbi Soloveitchik has, is Rosh Chodesh Man. I left the book at home, which actually, the original, but I found online where Rabbi Ronnie Zeiler on the VBM describes the Rosh Chodesh Man. So, Mindy, would you continue that?
In his eulogy for the Mizrahi leader, Rav Zev Gold, entitled V'Seser Uvegaloi, The Rav develops the character of the Ish Rosh Chodesh, the new month man. He is so called because Rosh Chodesh, the beginning of the month, is a day whose inner sanctity is almost completely shielded from public view. Although on Rosh Chodesh one goes about his daily routine, merely adding some additional prayers, the Torah groups it along with the major holidays, and his inner sanctity is fully revealed only within the precincts of the temple. Similarly, there are some personalities whose inner passion and sanctity are concealed beneath a solemn exterior, such as the Rav's father, or beneath a sparkling exterior, such as Rav Gold. Rav Soloveitchik confesses that he has always been attracted to such personalities, partially due to his upbringing. From childhood, I was taught to control my feelings and not to display what was taking place in my emotional world. Father, Zichron Levracha, used to say, "The holier the feeling, the more intimate it is, the more it needs to be buried in the depths." What is the holiest of places, if not the holy of holies of the emotional life? If man is full of joy and happiness, let him reveal his feelings to God, but let him not exhibit them to others, lest a stranger's look desecrate his holy of holies. If, on the contrary, man is given over to suffering and torment, let him confess before the Master of the universe, but let no stranger approach the holy of holies, for he might desecrate with indifference the sanctity of mute suffering oppressing men.
So I gave you two approaches to how he could say this and still be so emotional. Either he rejects this philosophy of his childhood, he admires the Rosh Chodesh man, Rosh Chodesh being a holiday that you can't see, right? On Rosh Chodesh, no one would know that I said Hallel that morning, right? Nothing about my daily activity on Rosh Chodesh reveals itself. But maybe he's not a Rosh Chodesh man. He admires Rosh Chodesh man. He eulogizes Rosh Chodesh man. He's not a Rosh Chodesh man. Reverend Salvatric is much more open about his personal Holy of Holies, or maybe he only does it for pedagogic reasons. Or maybe he's an existential philosopher who believes that you can only describe the philosophy and our experience of God is the truest philosophy, and therefore there's no other way of describing his philosophy other than to get personal about it, as we'll see in a minute. So what is this existentialism? So just a couple of things I lifted off the internet just to give us a little flavor of this. Again, for more about philosophy, speak to Rabbi Yoel, speak to Kaplowitz. They'll tell you. Read up on it on your own. But I think when we read these two paragraphs just about Neo-Kantian schools, which Hermann Cohen was part of, which Rabbi Salvatric wrote his work on Hermann Cohen, and we read about existentialism, which Rabbi Salvatric is an existentialist philosopher, I think you get a sense of where he's coming from, where his biography as an existentialist philosopher relates to some of the readings we had tonight. So who, let's see, who's on, want to continue?
On the existential view, to understand what a human being is not enough to know all the truth that natural science, including the science of psychology, could tell us. The dualist who holds that human
forget about all the proofs of God, all kinds of scientific things. That's not gonna do it. If you want to know your philosophy, you have to talk about your personal experience. Forget about psychology, natural science. It's not gonna answer your problems about God. Go ahead.
The dualist who holds that human beings are composed of independent substances, mind and body, is no better off in this regard than is the physicalist, who holds that human existence can be adequately explained in terms of the fundamental physical constituents of the universe. Existentialism does not deny the validity of the basic categories of physics, biology, psychology, and the other sciences.
When we say you shouldn't psychologize, it doesn't mean he's against psychology, but he go ahead.
It claims only that human beings cannot be fully understood in terms of them, nor can such an understanding be gained by supplementing our scientific picture with a moral one. Categories of moral theory, such as intention, blame, responsibility, character, duty, virtue, and the like, do capture important aspects of the human condition, but neither moral thinking, governed by the norms of good and right, nor scientific thinking, governed by the norm of truth, suffices.
I left out the main part. And what does tell us? What does tell us what about truth? Our experience. So in order to describe the truth of God, you have to talk about your experiences. That's where the truth of God lies. Or if we look here, go ahead, one last paragraph.
The neo-Kantian schools tended to emphasize scientific readings of Kant, often downplaying the role of intuition in favor of concepts.
There's an overlap between Hermann Cohen and Rabbi Chaim Salvatric, because both Hermann Cohen and Chaim Salvatric are interested in the concepts, not some intuition or something else. Go ahead.
Cohen's interpretation of Kant is thus robustly anti-psychologistic.
You see that? So Rabbi Salvatric's speaking against psychologization of the halakha, saying, well, the only reason we do that is because we blow the shofar, because we have some psychological need. Rather than talking about shofar as an absolute halachic category, and it's a reality, and we can codify it, we can describe it, and we can analyze it, his aversion to psychologizing things starts with Cohen's interpretation of Kant. Go ahead.
He thinks any consideration of how the human mind operates to produce representations is completely irrelevant to a philosophical theory of knowledge.
Right. So he doesn't think that that psychology and history and sociology can tell us about knowledge. Knowledge has to be understood in terms of concepts. So in any event, I hope that brings together a little bit here's a man with two aspects of his biography. There's the grandfather who seems so cold. Of course, maybe he's really not. We said from the very first paragraph that maybe there actually is a transformation of holy living cosmic phenomenon with this cold philosophy of the sunset. This is part of his tradition, is this cold side, and then on the other hand, he has the philosophical side. But the philosophical side is again not a cold reading of proofs of God's existence or something like that, but rather some sort of existentialism which speaks about his own personal experience. And whereas his father said you shouldn't, his grandfather said you should leave personal things as personal, he believes that the whole experience of really how to seek God comes through your personal experience. So you have these two books that he writes, his two major works that he wrote as a young person, Halachic Man, and then from There You Shall Seek, which was written when he was younger and came out in the 70s. It came out in the 70s. Yes, it only came out recently in English, and so it's really worth getting. So it could be that if you read Halachic Man as we used to when we were in Yeshiva, that was the basic book you could get. It was Halachic Man, you read Halachic Man, and they said, well, it's not really his philosophy, it's really his grandfather. Now you have to read, and from there you shall seek. Anyway, I hope we've opened up some of the issues that we'll be talking about in succeeding weeks. The idea of the greener pastures is the idea of life to sort of bring it all to one beautiful crescendo at the end, and everything works out beautifully, and we'll all walk on greener pastures. Or do we live in some kind of tension between the emotional and the categorical and the natural experience versus the revelational experience? Are we always in tension between different things, or do we ever actually resolve things? Is Rabbi Soloveitchik modern? Is he the father of modern Orthodoxy? How come he didn't even like that expression? Is he modern Orthodox? And what does it mean to be modern? And how was his relationship to modernity? We're talking about that as well. So lots of issues. What was the fourth issue we'll be dealing with? Sorry, I didn't bring it with me. The fourth issue. Oh, and spirituality. As we touched on it tonight, what is spirituality? And what's Rabbi Soloveitchik's view of spirituality? We began to touch on it. Of course, very much these two books will be coming back to that again. And of course, in dealing with modernity, we'll be reading more about The Lonely Man of Faith as well, one of his first works. So thank you for joining us tonight, and I hope it was a good taste of things to come.